From its origins in Victorian Britain to the gates of Auschwitz, this is the story of an idea which runs through the worst atrocities of the 20th century, an idea that echoes through the decades and resonates today. This is the story of eugenics. In this series so far, we've explored the emergence of eugenics in Victorian Britain and how this new scientified movement turbocharged political ideologies of the day: white supremacy, ableism, racism. We've explored how the idea was embraced in Jazz Age America and how it framed huge political issues such as immigration and birth control. But inevitably, when discussing eugenics, you end up in Nazi Germany. And that's where we will land in this episode. But we're not going to start in Germany, or even in Europe. We begin in America with a book. It's a book that was written while Europe was still engulfed in the Great War between 1914 and 1918. The author was a high society American of the old stock, a man called Madison Grant. Here's Professor Jonathan Spiro from Caston University in Vermont.
Madison Grant was born in Manhattan in 1865 into a very wealthy and distinguished American family. His father was descended from the first Puritan immigrants to New England. His great-grandfather was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. That's a big deal here in the States. And really, for the first fifth of his life, all he did was socialize in the elite men's clubs of Manhattan.
Rich kids love a project, so after an indolent start, Grant began to transform from Gatsby-ish socialite to ardent conservationist. He launched influential campaigns to protect the great redwoods and the American bison. He even established two national parks. But his interest in conservation gradually shifted from trees and animals to people.
And at some point in the beginning of the 20th century, he became concerned about the need for conserving not just flora and fauna, but also the best of the human species. So in 1916, he wrote The Passing of the Great Race. It employs the latest findings of science to claim that the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Nordics, that's a term invented by Grant, the Nordics, that they are the biggest, strongest, handsomest, and smartest of all the races.
In The Passing of the Great Race, Grant argues that old stock Americans like himself are in fact descendants of this great Nordic race via the first waves of colonizers who arrived from Britain, Germany, and Scandinavia in the 1700s. But Grant thinks that this great race is existentially threatened.
In the early 1900s, America is being swamped by millions of quote-unquote inferior immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe, dark-haired, dark-eyed immigrants who were predominantly Catholics and, worst of all, Jews. And so Grant, in his book, warns his fellow Nordics that we must prevent these inferior immigrants from polluting our blood or the great race will pass.
The book is wildly successful. In the US, it goes through four editions in 5 years. But it also catches on around the world. It's translated into French and Norwegian, Swedish and German. Grant becomes famous and widely celebrated. In the US, he's the most famous of all the eugenicists, his influence global. In 1934, a friend of Grant's, Leon Whitney, paid him a visit in his stately Fifth Avenue apartment in Manhattan.
Leon Whitney was a conservationist who was visiting with Madison Grant one day, and they got to talking about the passing of the great race, and Madison Grant smiled, opened the drawer to his desk, and pulled out a letter from Adolf Hitler, in which Hitler informed Grant that he was his biggest fan and that The Passing of the Great Race is my Bible.
The Nordic race, by the way, also gets referred to as Aryan. And one translation of the Great Race is the German word Herrenvolk, literally the master race.
All the leaders of the Nazi Party read it, or if they hadn't read it, they pretended they had read it to each other, because certainly all the leading eugenicists in Germany read it. Grant was in direct contact for many, many years with all the leading geneticists and eugenicists in the Weimar Republic. So when the Nazis gained power, they began to systematically implement all of Grant's ideas as laid out in The Passing of the Great Race.
Years later, after the Third Reich has fallen, Grant's book makes another surprising appearance.
At the Nuremberg trials after World War II, when the Allies put the surviving leaders of the Third Reich on trial, the Nazi defendants entered Madison Grant's Passing of the Great Race as a defense exhibit to justify their policy of anti-Semitic genocide. And so the Allied judges at Nuremberg had to deal with the extremely uncomfortable fact that the Nazis were tracing their Holocaust back to an American conservationist.
For decades after the full horrors of Nazi atrocities were exposed in 1945, the Nazi regime was portrayed as a uniquely grotesque aberration, a nationalism born of the singular vision of a mad despot. But as the story of Madison Grant suggests, that isn't entirely accurate. As the decades passed, historians found more and more evidence of international connection and continuity in the eugenics movement and in the eugenic policies pursued by the Third Reich. Professor Stefan Kuhl from Bielefeld University in Germany was part of the shifting approach to understanding Nazi eugenics that occurred from the 1980s onwards.
When I started doing research about eugenics, it was very much limited to a national perspective. And for me, it was interesting to see that there were quite a lot of international connections between eugenicists. It was a scientific movement, and because science is globally oriented, there was quite a lot of exchange between eugenicists all over the world, starting in the early 20th century.
In fact, eugenics in Germany did not start in the Third Reich at all.
Alfred Plötz, probably one of the founding fathers of the race hygiene movement in Germany, he was very keen on learning about the development in other countries. So you can see already at the beginning a very close connection to other scientists outside Germany.
Alfred Plötz had already begun his eugenic odyssey before Hitler was born. As a young man, he had toyed with socialism, but after spending some unhappy time on a communal farm in Iowa, he became convinced of the need for the racial purity of the Nordic people, and even swore a dramatic oath under an oak tree that he would commit his life to elevating Germany to the mythical status of Teutonic legend. In 1890, unaware of Francis Galton's work, or even the term eugenics, Plötz wrote a book, The Excellence of Our Race and the Protection of the Weak. In it, he coins the word Rassenhygiene. Just like personal hygiene protects the body from infection, race hygiene would keep the Nordic people pure. This became the byword for German eugenics for the next 50 years. In 1933, Hitler was appointed Chancellor, and by March, the Enabling Act had mutated his government into a de facto dictatorship. The precise mechanisms and machinations by which the Nazis seized power is a tale for another time, another programme. Our task here is to investigate how they transformed Germany into an efficient and murderous eugenic state at such a breakneck speed. Within 6 months of taking power, the Nazis established themselves as the only legal party in Germany, suppressing all organised political opposition. Once power was secured, they rushed to establish their eugenic programmes into law. In July 1933, Hitler's government passed the Law for the Prevention of Offspring with Hereditary Diseases, also known as the Sterilisation Law. Its aim was to eliminate what they considered to be genetic diseases or defects from the population. It allowed for the involuntary surgical sterilisation of men and women deemed to have physical and mental disabilities or showing signs of mental illness. But just as much of Hitler's personal inspiration came from the United States, the Nazis didn't dream up this law themselves. This is Amy Carney, Associate Professor of History at Penn State Behrend, Pennsylvania.
The discussion on sterilization in the German government had actually begun in 1932, so that is before Hitler had been appointed chancellor. And a draft of the law had already been written. And this draft was based on already existing sterilization laws, including the model law that Harry Laughlin had written in the United States.
It was this document, amongst others, that the Nazis drew upon in concocting their first enforced sterilization bill. It was reported with admiration later that year, in December 1933, after the law had been passed, but before the sterilization program was underway, in the New York Times.
400,000 Germans to be sterilized. 1,700 hereditary health courts will start judging cases of alleged unfit from January the 1st.
So again, the law was passed in July 1933. It went into effect in 1934. And between 1934 and the start of World War II in 1939, some 375,000 people were sterilized. The war slowed down the sterilizations, but by the end of the Third Reich, almost 400,000 people had been sterilized, and many of them had been sterilized against their will.
These numbers far, far exceed the sterilizations performed in the USA and other countries, and in much less time. How did the German state achieve such terrifying efficiency? Who was making the diagnoses, and who was performing these operations? Well, everyday family doctors, the general practitioners, were a key part of the process. They suggested candidates for sterilization. Professor Sheila Weiss from Clarkson University in Potsdam, New York.
The physicians, and here we talk about family physicians, were basically obliged to present the names of all those who met the criteria of the Nazi sterilization law. And if they objected to the procedure, then it would go in front of one of the numerous genetic health courts staffed by two physicians and a jurist.
You might think that doctors would be hesitant to volunteer their patients for sterilization. Do no harm is the primary principle of medicine. Were they coerced? Probably not. German doctors appear to have been enthusiastic in their embrace of Nazi eugenics.
German physicians joined the Nazi Party in numbers higher than any other professional group. And that says something, because they were certainly not forced to do this.
And even before the Nazis were in power, the German doctors saw themselves as responsible not just for the individual well-being of their patients, but for the health of the people, or the race. Here's Stefan Kuhl again.
It was always the idea that doctors were not only responsible for the individual patient, but they were also responsible for the Volksgesundheit, for the health of the whole people, of the whole population. So they always had the two aspects. It was very easy for the Nazis to use this double conception in order to implement their race policy.
This, in fact, is the justification used by all eugenicists. The well-being of the nation or the race over the individual.
The whole Nazi ideology is based on the idea that the individual is nothing. The race is everything.
The next step in creating the eugenic state was to formalize Nazi anti-Semitism. Racial hierarchies are common to most forms of eugenics, and the Nazi racial hierarchy placed Jews at the bottom, a threat to the racial purity of the German nation. Now, this might seem obvious, but anti-Semitism was not always a necessary part of eugenic policies. Indeed, some of the earliest German eugenicists, such as Alfred Plötz, ranked Jews very highly in their racial hierarchies and suggested that Nordic people should breed with Jews for the betterment of the race. But Hitler's anti-Semitism was virulent, persuasive, and popular. In 1935, the Nuremberg Laws were passed, declaring that only Germans who were sufficiently pure could be citizens of the Reich, and marriage or sexual relations between Jews and non-Jewish Germans were outlawed. The law for the protection of German blood and German honour defined who counted as Jewish.
As with the sterilization law, American law served as a model for the blood part of the blood and honor law. German lawyers had examined American anti-miscegenation laws.
More than half of US states had these laws preventing marriage between white people and black people. But the Germans wanted a definition of who counted as Jewish. So how far back did you have to go to determine whether someone was really Jewish or not? Yet again, the precedent was America. Their classification of black meant having any single black ancestor in your family tree. The one drop rule, meaning one drop of black blood.
Some German officials wanted to consider using a one drop rule. That is, one drop of Jewish blood would make a person Jewish. German lawyers were impressed with how these laws defined race. But ultimately, they decided that the American laws were too extreme.
Too extreme. The American one-drop laws were too extreme for the Nazis. Instead, the Germans came up with a convoluted hierarchy of different levels of Jewishness, depending on ancestry and cultural practices. These rules were made up and invented logic. Medical professionals were on board with the policies of race hygiene, but how to get the people to support these ideas too, to normalise these classifications? I paid a visit to the Wiener Holocaust Library in London to see how eugenic ideas were dripped into everyday life. Senior curator Dr. Barbara Warnock showed me some homework.
So this is a schoolwork of Gerda Naber.
Who's just a pupil?
Just a pupil in Germany in 1935.
Oh, right there on the front page, in very neat writing, is a family tree.
Yes, this is the Nuremberg race laws in diagrammatic form. And she did quite a bit of work on this and got full marks from her teacher for her very neat, carefully drawn diagram.
And I can see from this sort of pedigree that she's drawn out, some of the boxes are shaded and there's a code at the bottom. The empty boxes are, say, Deutscher, German, and the shaded boxes say Judah, Jew.
Yes.
So she's describing the inheritance of Jewishness.
Yes, and in this particular case...
The Nuremberg Laws of 1935 defined who counted as fully Jewish and who counted as mischling or mixed in varying degrees. And here in this schoolgirl's homework are those racist eugenic laws, neatly drawn out and labelled in the form of family trees. It's good work, well drawn on square graph paper. Looks like the type of school project that my kids or any kids might do today.
So it looks like a really standard issue, I don't know, sort of 11-year-old's project. And there's a mark on there.
Yes, so the teacher's given this, I think, one stroke two, so quite a high mark.
But it is fascinating that this is right there in a school-age kid's project.
And the fact that actually the schoolwork comes from pretty much around the same time that the laws were launched. So this teacher were kind of immediately educating their students about the Nuremberg laws and the ways in which Jews were defined and Jews were excluded, therefore.
It's an example of Nazi ideology translating from government into the classroom really swiftly. Barbara has another example from school.
One object that I've got here is actually a school maths textbook, and it's an arithmetic book. And it's for students of between about 12 and 14 years old.
So it's a normal size book, Rechenbuch für Volksschulen, which means...
So it's a workbook for students, using the word Volk ahead of the word Schulen, students, implies, kind of students who are members of the German people is the implication. So it's interesting, in fact, that, the word Volk has been put ahead of the word student there. So what's quite striking here is this particular diagram, and it's to do with the students calculating the cost of what's been called the hereditarily ill and the cost to the state of this.
So I can see the word Erbkranker, which I know is that's krank means illness and erb means inheritance or
yes.
heritable, right?
Yes.
So it's right there.
Yes, it is. And so it says it costs, you know, for 1 year in a hospital, it costs 3,000 Reichsmark. And then it kind of makes this calculation that apparently that's the entire kind of yearly output of two workers in the German state.
Goodness me. So this is a textbook for children. And one of the exercises is to calculate how much the state pays to maintain the existence of people who would fit into the category of undesirable.
Yes, it's very much emphasising to the students the idea that those who have physical and mental disabilities are a drain and a burden on the state.
Using education to spread Nazi ideology was not just happening in a few isolated cases. Textbooks were quickly populated with these ideas. One of the key disciplines, a subject which gained a huge credibility boost when the Nazis came to power, was, of course, biology. Professor Sheila Weiss.
Biology and biology teachers gained influence and prestige during the Third Reich that they hadn't had before.
Eugenics is an ideology, a way of thinking that uses science as a crutch. The prejudices and politics of the powerful dressed up as scientific fact.
As several important Nazis put it, Nazism is simply political biology.
And still, as war was looking inevitable, Hitler wished to further enshrine the state's ability to enact eugenics into law. But he needed to challenge the law as it stood. On the 20th of February 1939, a son was born to the farmers Richard and Lena Kretschmar in a village near Leipzig. The boy, whose name was Gerhard, was severely disabled with one arm, one or no legs, reports differ. He was blind and suffered from convulsions. The parents, both Nazi supporters, asked the local Leipzig hospital to have the baby killed. They described him as a monster. The professor of paediatrics there, a man called Werner Kattel, informed them that to kill the baby was illegal, but suggested that they petitioned the Führer directly. Hitler sent his personal physician, Karl Brandt, to investigate, with the instruction that if the depiction of this baby's condition were accurate, then he was authorised to end its life. Brandt and Kattel concurred, and Gerhard Kretschmar was killed on the 25th of July. And with this test case unchallenged, the Third Reich initiated what became known as Action T4, their euthanasia programme.
The term euthanasia, a word normally taken to mean ending the life of a terminally ill patient to limit their suffering, was in fact a Nazi euphemism for a campaign of mass murder of individuals who, allegedly owing to serious genetic defects, were considered useless eaters by the Nazi state.
Useless eaters. The attitude we encountered in the arithmetic textbook, that the disabled and the sick were a crushing and unnecessary burden on the state. This was cashed out in a nationwide programme of literally murdering disabled children, those deemed Lebensunwertensleben, lives unworthy of life. How did such a process work? Children already in mental and medical institutions were targeted, either killed or left to die. But often parents were encouraged to hand over older children with the promise that they would receive better care at special institutions.
The parents were often told that their children would receive better treatment if they were given over to these special psychiatric hospitals. And many of the T4 physicians said, look, you know, you're a young woman, you can have many more healthy children. Give your unhealthy child to us and we will give it the best possible care.
They didn't. The children were killed. Sometimes the parents were told that they died of illness, when in fact they'd been executed, sometimes by starvation or gassed with carbon monoxide. How could doctors do this? Stefan Kuhl thinks that, given their embrace of eugenic ideas and the policy of sterilization, it wasn't such a huge leap.
A lot of the doctors in Germany were very closely linked to the Nazi parties. So, of course, it was a difference for them to promote sterilization, moving on to killing patients in the institutions. But it was not such a big step. So I don't see any systematic resistance of doctors against eugenic policy at this time period. The other way around, they were one of the active promoting professional groups in the killing of mentally handicapped and mentally ill.
The policy was officially ended in 1941 after mass protests by the German people, but the killings continued until 1945. And the technology developed to enact the executions was adopted in the concentration camps where millions were killed.
The project can rightly be viewed as the antechamber to the death camps. The same technology of gassing was used, and about 96 of 400 T4 personnel were redeployed in the East in the service of the final solution after the so-called official stop of the euthanasia program.
We arrive now at the gates of Auschwitz, where our story has inevitably been heading. It's in the concentration camps like this, and Dachau and Treblinka and others, that 6 million Jews, along with millions of Russians, Poles, Serbs and Roma, were gassed and killed. Ultimately, the policies of the Third Reich were deranged and haphazardly drew from many sources, ideologies and religions, and overwhelmingly from Hitler's commitment to Aryan superiority and fanatical anti-Semitism. These were both ideas born of hatred, but they were propped up by what Nazis and the Americans who inspired them thought of as science. The authority of science was used to justify genocide. Science marshalled into ideology, bigotry disguised as biology. In the next episode of Bad Blood, we're going back to school to find out what the science actually says, from Mendel and his famous peas to family trees.